Were we on? I'll try it again. Once again, I will call the House Committee on Health Care to order and open a work session on Senate Bill 1562A.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, 1562A had a public hearing on the 19th. You'll recall this modifies the requirements for health insurance coverage of services, medications, and supplies necessary for the management of diabetes during pregnancy. It clarifies the notification requirements between practitioner and the insurers. You do have some amendments before you, and before we get into the amendments, we do have all the proper paperwork, the fiscal and the revenue on the A-9s and the A-11s.
Representative Conger.
Time for me to move the amendment. Mr. Chair, I move the A-9 amendment dated 2/20/2014 be adopted to Senate Bill 1562A.
Representative Conger moves the A-9 amendments dated 2/20/14 to be added to the Senate Bill 1562. I got that right, first thing. Will you describe it for us?
Certainly. The A-9 amendments direct the executive director of the Oregon Health Insurance Exchange, known as Cover Oregon, to report to the House and Senate Health Care Committees on the first meeting following sine die of the session in 2014, which I believe would be in May.
May 28th, I think.
Mm-hmm. And then it sets out some of the information to be covered in that report, including a new updated business plan reflecting, obviously, further clarity on enrollment numbers, demographic information on enrollees, et cetera. And that's what the A-9 amendment does. And I want to just point out that this is the third time that I have brought this rough concept, and I want to acknowledge the willingness of Chair Greenlich to work with me to bring the amendment, to make sure that it's drafted correctly. We made some changes to it and get this into the bill. And I think my intent always in bringing this has been to specify information that I feel like I would be having it would help me make better decisions about the future of Cover Oregon. We have a lot of information, and others on the committee and elsewhere have shared with me that they're frustrated a little bit that we can't get some of the information that we're requesting. And again, working with the chair, we modified the timeline to provide the information so that it is reasonable for Cover Oregon and its executive director to bring it back to the legislature.
And there's no opposition to this. Everybody seems okay with it. Is there any discussion on this amendment? Is there any objection?
You didn't get my public option in there, did you?
A-9s are... Yeah. Clem, you didn't have a chance.
I want to tell you.
Look, there's another amendment.
The relating clause on this one?
I know.
And I said
amendment
nothing.
Is in the bill. Representative Conger?
Mr. Chair, I move the dash 11 amendments dated February 21st, 2014 be adopted to Senate Bill 1562A.
Representative Conger moves the A-11 amendments dated 2/21/14 be added to Senate Bill 1562A. Want to describe this one?
Yes, sir. The dash 11 amendments would require any agency that receives or commissions an audit or independent review or investigation of Cover Oregon to provide the report from that investigation to the board of Cover Oregon. It then further requires the board and the executive director of Cover Oregon to make that report available to the public upon request. And again, I know you've seen this amendment before. I want to acknowledge again the work of the chair to get this to a place where we felt like it was right, where it would accomplish the purpose but not be overly burdensome. And There were some mechanics, interestingly enough, in my in the original draft of the amendment that I think were just unclear. And so I think we've clarified that, how it's supposed to work. We've clarified what the intent is. And it's, again, you've heard me say this before, but I'll repeat it for the record. The goal is really to make sure that this information is made public so that members of the public know that they have access to it. And we can start restoring the public's faith in Cover Oregon and in the state government for being transparent, regardless of what's in the reports. The public and the legislature have a right, and the legislature at least has an obligation to know. So this will, I think, help to make it clear that we are standing on that ground and saying we need to have transparency and we need to have full disclosure. And one thing I want to make sure for the record, and I'll read this on the House floor as well, the requirement in Section 2 of the Dash 11 amendments that agencies make available reports or findings resulting from an independent review, investigation, or audit of the development, implementation, or quality control of the health insurance exchange is not intended to apply to information that is otherwise made confidential by law, such as vulnerability reports or reports containing trade secrets. I think that was obvious. Obviously, we didn't intend for trade secrets and information that would make it easier for people to hack into Cover Oregon public, but for the record, wanted to make sure everybody understood that.
Is there any discussion? Anything about a public option?
No.
Apparently not. Okay. Is there any objection? A11s are part of Senate Bill 1562. Is there any discussion on the bill as amended?
Chairman.
Yes, sir.
I just wanted to thank you for working on these and trying to make this a better bill. Appreciate it.
I think it is. In better shape now. Yeah.
You're really lousing up your image as an unreasonable person.
I'll get it back.
Yeah. I'm scouting on that.
I have confidence. you have a motion.
I do have a motion, Mr. Chair. I move Senate Bill 1562A as amended with the A9 and A11 amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Thompson moves Senate Bill 1562A as amended with the -9 and the -11 amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on the motion? Would you call the roll, please?
Representative Kinnemer?
Aye.
Representative Lively?
Aye.
Representative Wagner?
Aye.
Representative Clem?
Aye.
Representative Conger?
Aye.
Representative Parker?
Aye.
Vice Chair Kenny Geyer?
She's excused and we'll let her vote. She had to go next door to testify. We'll get her back when she comes in.
Vice Chair Thompson?
Aye.
And Chair
Greenway. Aye. Motion carried. Perhaps Representative Conger and I can co-carry this.
Absolutely.
Close the work session on Senate Bill 1562. Incidentally, I talked this over with the Senate Chair, and she'll have no problem concurring with the amendments. Did I close the work session just now? We're going to open an informational hearing on the biologic and health effects of microwaves. We have two people scheduled to testify, is that right?
We do, Mr. Chair.
Can we ask them to...
Can you gentlemen, are you willing to come up together?
At least come up here.
Yes, come up.
It's Martin Paul, mm-hmm. Professor Emeritus of Biochemistry and Basic Medical Sciences from Washington State University, and Paul Dart, MD, and I apologize, sir, I'm not sure what the other acronym stands for.
A fellow of the Cranial Academy.
Thank you.
It's not particularly relevant to this discussion.
In order to be eligible to testify in this informational hearing, you have to have Paul in your name. Whatever order you'd like.
Okay. I thought maybe there'd be something. Oh, I see. We have something over here. Okay. So maybe I'll... Okay, so basically, the basic thrust of my talk is that
Oh, yeah, you have to introduce yourself, please, before you
okay.
speak.
Okay, I'm Martin Paul, Professor Emeritus of Biochemistry and Basic Medical Sciences, and I'll give you a little more information on the next slide.
That's what we need for the record.
Okay. So we have electromagnetic fields have been argued to work, microwave electromagnetic fields have been argued to work entirely by heating in terms of health effects. And what my talk says is that that's incorrect, that they produce health effects via VGCC, and I'll explain what that is in a minute, activation, okay? So, and this is a little bit about my background. I got my bachelor's degree at Johns Hopkins. I actually got it in physics. Took a lot of chemistry and biology classes. Got a PhD in biochemistry and genetics from Caltech. I'm Professor Emeritus of Biochemistry and Basic Medical Sciences at Washington State University. I've received 7 international honors for my work in environmental medicine, and these are all on chemical work, not on electrical work. I published a paper last year on how electromagnetic fields, which are usually abbreviated EMFs, impact the cells of our bodies, and that's going to be pretty central to what I'm talking about there. This paper was just honored for inclusion as a global medical discovery paper. So that means it's, according to this site, one of the top medical publications of 2013. I have given already 4 professional talks on this topic, and by the end of next month,
What was the journal that was published in, did you say?
It was the Journal of Cellular and Molecular Medicine.
Thank you.
And I've got the citation on one of these slides. Mm-hmm. Now, U.S. and international safety standards for microwave radiation don't directly apply to devices that fall within the control of the state of Oregon, but because they have often been used to claim safety for state-controlled devices, they're relevant to the discussion here. And so these safety standards are entirely based, as I said before, on the assumption that the only thing that's important, at least, that microwave EMFs can do is to heat things, like heating foods in your microwave oven. And therefore, they assume that if heating is minimal, you don't have to worry about health effects. And that's the basic assumption behind all these safety standards. In fact, there's no basis for that. And the reason that we know that is, first of all, there are some 20,000 papers in the scientific literature showing biological effects where there should be none according to the safety standards. Okay, so there's a huge literature reporting all kinds of changes that shouldn't exist according to the safety standards. Secondly, it's been known for over 30 years that pulse fields are more biologically active than non-pulse fields, even when they don't produce any more heating or they even produce less heating than the non-pulse fields. And so we know from that again, heating is not the crucial thing. And then now we know what the actual main mechanism is, which is what that paper was about. Now let me just say there's a lot of complexities to this thing. Don't worry about the complexities. What I'm trying to do is give you a feeling for how all this stuff kind of fits together, okay? What my paper showed, and let me just say this was entirely other people's data that was kind of hiding in the literature, okay, is that there were 24 studies which showed that electromagnetic fields produce biological responses through the activation of what are called voltage-gated calcium channels, VGCCs, okay? And the reason that we know that is because if you use a calcium channel blocker, which is a drug that's specific to block these channels, it blocks the effects. And so in 24 studies, we know that that this is the way the biological response was produced. Now, these are not all just on microwaves. There are a number of different kinds of EMF fields that were involved. And so this seems to be a very broad kind of mechanism.
They were all non-ionizing radiation.
They're all non-ionizing radiation, that's correct. And they're all low-energy photons in these. So what happens then is when you have these channels, they're in the plasma membrane of the cells. And when they get activated, they open up, and calcium flows into the cell. And it's the excess calcium in the cell, the intracellular calcium, that is responsible for most, if not all, of the biological responses. Okay? So we have a pathway then that produces this big increase in intracellular calcium. And a lot of the effects we know from increased intracellular calcium go through activation of these two enzymes. These are nitric oxide synthases that are calcium dependent. Okay, so they have very low activity unless you've got a lot of calcium in the cell. And when the calcium goes into the cell, you get a big elevation of nitric oxide. Okay, now nitric oxide, it turns out, can work along two different pathways in the body. And again, I apologize for the complexities, but basically this is the pathway, there's the normal physiological pathway of action of nitric oxide. So this is the way when nitric oxide is doing good things in the body, this is the way it works. It works through this the signaling pathway, okay? And this is the way in which nitric oxide works in diseases. And so it combines with this guy to form peroxynitrite, which is a potent oxidant, produces oxidative stress, and produces all kinds of changes in the body which are involved in various kinds of diseases. Okay, so both of these are relevant. Now, it turns out, and this is going to be sort of the simple take-home lesson of my talk, is that this pathway over here is the way in which therapeutic effects of microwaves works. And there are therapeutic effects of microwaves, and they occur under certain specific conditions, and it works along this pathway. And what I'm going to say is this pathway is involved in most, but not quite all, of the pathophysiological effects, the damaging effects. Okay.
And so, question?
Yeah.
So is the bifurcation due solely to the presence or a certain level of the superoxide?
It's due to that, and also the level as most of these things, is very complex. But yes, basically, it depends on superoxide, and it depends also on how much nitric oxide you have. Because basically, you have to have a lot of nitric oxide and a lot of superoxide both. Okay.
We're talking multiple cells.
All
right.
Question.
Good enough. Let you go.
Yeah.
Go.
Right.
It's
actually very complex, but this is something I've been studying for the last 15 years, and so I probably know more than I should. Okay. Now, what I have in this slide is a series of well-documented effects by microwave EMF exposures that can be understood as being caused by the mechanism shown on the previous slide. Okay, so these are all extremely well-documented changes, with one exception I'll mention in a minute. So we know that these things occur, and they can all be explained by that previous slide. Okay, so you have oxidative stress, which we've already talked about. You have breaks in both single-strand and double-strand DNA. You get cancer, and those involve the breaks in the DNA, but also certain other things. You get male and female infertility, and let me just say, male infertility has been studied a lot more than female infertility. It's a whole lot easier to study, but there's reason to think that both occur. You have a breakdown of the blood-brain barrier, and what that does is when you get a breakdown of the blood-brain barrier, it makes the brain more susceptible to both toxic chemicals and also infectious agents. And so that's obviously important. You have a loss of melatonin, which is a hormone that controls sleep, and consequently you get sleep disruption. And then you have the therapeutic effects. And so all of these can be explained by that pathway that we just talked about. There are other effects that occur. There are many changes in brain function that have been reported. These are very diverse.
Can I ask a question at this point?
Yeah.
To what extent are these things dose-dependent? And by dose, in this case, it means the intensity, I assume the intensity of...
Yeah.
And therefore the distance from the source and a variety of...
Well, they're all dose-dependent. These all occur within current safety standards. Okay? So what that tells you is that the safety standards are inadequate in terms of all of these things. And I'm not saying that industry won't contest the reality of these things, but that's what the literature says. Okay. And I've gone through a lot of this literature carefully, and some of it not so carefully, but these things are all been reported over and over and over again. By multiple groups and so forth. Anyway, there are changes in brain function. We really don't understand what the significance of that is, the biological significance yet. But there are a lot of these VGCCs in the brain, and they're very important in the brain. So it's not surprising that you see changes in brain function. There are also changes in electrical control of the heart, and I'll talk a little bit about that. And those include tachycardia, rapid heartbeat, arrhythmia, and arrhythmia can lead to sudden cardiac death. So this is a significant issue that one might be concerned about. So in general, then, we have multiple studies showing that each of these responses have been reported to be produced by microwave radiation exposures of various sorts. There may be arguments about how strong the evidence is, and I'm sure there will be, but there should be no question there is substantial evidence. None of these can be explained by heating. Okay. And they can all be explained by this VGCC activation. Okay, so I want to talk a little bit about autism. I'm working on a paper on autism. And there are a number of researchers who have argued that the autism epidemic, and I'm talking specifically about the epidemic, may be caused primarily by microwave EMFs. And the main argument for that is that there's a tremendous parallelism between this huge increase in autism and the increase in EMF exposures that we've had over the last 35 years. But there are also some other types of evidence, and I'm just going to have time to share one of those types of evidence. Okay? So one of the predictions of this, if this is true, and that's the question, if this is largely caused by microwave EMF exposures, one of the predictions is that autism should be caused by excessive activity of the VGCCs, right? And it turns out we know that that's true, okay? And the reason we know this is true is because there's a mutation in the main VGCC in the brain. It's got this kind of designation. You don't need to worry about that. And it causes what's called Timothy syndrome. This is a rare mutation in that gene that makes it hyperactive. So it makes it hyperactive, and it causes Timothy syndrome. And the symptoms of Timothy syndrome are autism, and in fact the whole autism spectrum, and also cardiac changes that we talked about before, tachycardia, arrhythmia, sudden cardiac death. It causes both of them. And in fact, these people with Timothy syndrome don't live very long. They typically die age 4, 5, 6, 7. The oldest one lived to be 13, I think. So they die of sudden cardiac death. Okay. So in fact, you can take this mutant gene, it's actually derivative of the gene, and put it into the mouse. And when you do that, you get classic autism symptoms in the mouse. Okay? So there's no question that this thing is causing autism. Now, there's a whole bunch of other types of evidence which argue that the autism epidemic may be caused by microwave EMS, and we don't have time to talk about those.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
There are other forms of non-ionizing radiation, such as radio frequency radiation, that has been around for a long, long time.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a dose issue or?
Microwaves and radio frequency, of course, run into each other, but.
But RF's been around a lot.
I'll address some of this in my talk pretty specifically.
Okay, we'll get to that.
Okay.
Thank you.
Good. Okay, so let's see. In summary, these things are all things that could not possibly occur if the current safety standards are correct. They're all very serious health issues. we can substantially improve the safety of many of these devices that are putting out these fields relatively easily, I think. But I do have serious concerns about the specifics, which I think many people are concerned about, Wi-Fi in the schools and so-called smart meters, and also baby monitors, which are currently very poorly designed. Those, I think, really need serious changes. Anyway, I've discussed those the first two in my paper, which I think you have access to, which is another paper that was just published or just been accepted, I guess. And so you have a difficult challenge, and I want to thank you for working on this. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Before we go to the next speaker, can I have a motion to suspend the rules to allow Representative Kenny?
So moved.
Any objection? Your vote?
Aye.
Yes.
Aye.
Yes. Okay.
Aye as amended.
Did we do it well enough?
Well, yes, you did.
And now I will close the work session. Senate Bill 1562, I think.
Yes.
Thank you. I'm sorry for the interruption. I wanted to make sure we did this while we still had a quorum around. Please introduce yourself. Dr. Paul, you don't need to leave. You can hang on a bit. Oh, yeah, good.
And just for the committee's information, we'll be putting this link up on OLIS on a separate document. So.
Okay. I'm Paul Dart. I'm an MD. I practice in Eugene, Oregon. I grew up in Eugene, graduated from South Eugene High School, went to the University of California, Santa Cruz, where I majored in psychology. I returned to school in 1978 to study pre-med and went to the Mayo Clinic's Medical School in Rochester, Minnesota, graduated in 1984. I did an internship at Oregon Health Sciences University in family practice, then a fellowship in environmental medicine in Chicago. And I practice full-time in Eugene. My practice is limited to osteopathic manipulation and environmental medicine. I see a lot of people with chronic pain, headaches, that kind of thing.
Maybe you can move the mic a little closer, I'm afraid. Not too close.
Not too close.
Not too close.
You keep coaching me, I will get there.
Yeah, that's good. Thank you.
As Dr. Paul said, the FCC guidelines address the thermal effects of RF exposure, and he's discussed in some detail that there's a great deal of evidence suggesting that there are biological effects that occur at much lower power levels. I'm going to talk about two different kinds of problems, acute symptoms from RF exposure, symptoms people get, such as headaches, pain, behavior changes, various things like that, but are often referred to as electrical hypersensitivity syndrome, or EHS. And then I'll talk about some of the chronic changes caused by damage to DNA, cancer, and infertility. And what I'm going to do is show you the results of research in the literature on this subject. The acute symptoms of microwave radiation were first described by Russian researchers in the 1950s, and the Russians used their knowledge of this to harass the U.S. Embassy in Moscow. Between 1953 and 1978, they beamed microwave radio at the embassy from a roof of another building nearby, exposed embassy staff. Experienced statistically significant excess of several problems, depression, irritability, concentration problems, memory loss, ear problems, skin problems, vascular problems, and some other health difficulties. All this was studied by an epidemiologist at Johns Hopkins at the request of the State Department. In Lenora, Spain, in 2001, researchers compared symptoms of residents within Circle A compared to residents in the area B outside these two circles. Area B was more than 250 meters from the cell tower that had been installed in the city. And they found significant differences in various symptoms. When you see an asterisk here on top of one of these bars, that means that there's a statistically significant difference between this value and this value. So we're comparing people far away versus people close to the tower, and we have in these symptoms significant increases with people closer to the tower. The average exposure close to the tower was 0.11 microwatts per centimeter squared. The FCC guidelines for exposure are 600 to 1,000 microwatts per centimeter squared. In France, research was done in urban environments questioning 530 people who live near cell phone towers. And they looked to see, they stratified the data by how far from the tower these people lived. And at areas closer to the tower, they saw a statistical significant increase in symptoms, including irritability, headache, sleep disruption, depression, memory loss.
The dose falls off what, at the cube of the distance from the...
Yes, yes, the farther you get from the tower, the fewer people are complaining of these symptoms. Exactly.
Cube? It's a square.
No, the cube, I think, right?
No, it would be... Well, the simple mathematics of it is the square of the distance, but it's not that simple when you're using a pulsed beacon that's directed in certain directions. So... it's not quite as simple as that, but it's with the square of the distance of what we were taught in our physics classes. Yeah. A city in Egypt where they installed a cell phone tower in 1998, researchers studied 85 inhabitants living near this first cell phone tower in the city and compared symptoms of various kinds to people living farther away from the tower. And exposed individuals had significant increase in headaches, memory changes, dizziness, depression, sleep disturbance, tremors, and in some other things too. This talk is very truncated. You're going to get a PDF copy of this that's like an hour and 20 minute discussion, and there's more data in all of these studies that I'm showing you in this brief talk. In Denmark, several studies were done on the Danish birth cohort, where half the women in Denmark were asked to fill out questionnaires before pregnancy, and they collected a lot of data. And then they looked at the health status of these children at age 7 years of age. They found, and they were comparing in this study, cell phone exposure during the pregnancy and after the pregnancy. And children who were exposed in pregnancy and afterwards had statistically significant increase in behavior problems at age 7. And they saw this increase in all these different problems.
This is presumably the mom's cell phone use.
During pregnancy, yes, we can assume so. The children may have been using them, or the parents may have been using them, after that. And that's discussed in more detail in the articles. I don't have time to parse it out in that level of detail. They saw, as they looked at how much the cell phone was being used after delivery, once you got up to 2 calls a day or more, you started seeing a significant increase in symptoms. So it wasn't necessarily huge amounts of use. They also looked in another study with the same research base, headaches in young children, and saw an increase in migraine headaches and in other headache symptoms. Now, this is a study that involves, this particular study, 52,680 children. So this is pretty solid data when you look at a group that large. Now, this is a graph from France showing measurements of exposure levels in urban area in France, and they've increased dramatically between 2000 and 2011 here in this study, in this graphic. And over that period of time, the prevalence of people who self-report as saying, I have reactions to EMF, I react to cell towers, cell phones, various things like that. In various studies, these percentages are increasing over time. And that parallels the increase in exposures. A reasonable guess right now in the West Coast here, research in California several years ago, 3 to 5%. This data from various studies, you're all going to get a copy of all of that. But in Austria in 2004, 2% of the population self-identified this way. In 2008, 29% said they had some adverse reaction, and 3.5% had enough difficulty they'd consulted a physician about it. Now I'm going to shift from talking about electrical hypersensitivity to discussing DNA damage and its consequences. This is a picture of a very sensitive assay for DNA damage. You expose a rat's brain, and then you sacrifice the rat and take a lot of the cells, separate out the DNA, separate out the different chromosomes, and have them migrate under an electric charge through a media. And if the chromosome is intact, it'll all migrate together. But if it's been fragmented, the fragments are different weight, different electrical charge, and you get a comet-like tail spread out behind the main migration. You can measure the length of this tail and quantify the amount of fragmentation in the DNA. And it's been demonstrated here on this. We're talking about an exposure 2 hours a day for 35 days at one-third of the FCC exposure limit. And we see significant increase in length of the head and the tail, meaning there's more fragments of DNA. And dozens of studies have been done now showing this and showing it with increasingly weaker levels of signal. At the same time, you can document a decrease in the amount of oxidants in the tissue, of antioxidants in the tissue, because they're getting consumed by oxidative stress. And you can show a decrease in melatonin in the exposed animals. Because when you produce a lot of free radicals of oxidation, then you have to consume these antioxidants to defend the tissues against it. Now, if you create a lot of damage to DNA, there are going to be health consequences to this, and that will include the promotion of cancer, reduced fertility, and some other things. This is an epidemiologic study looking at the health of all members of the American Radio Relay League, ham radio operators, in Washington and California between 1971 and 1983. This is the expected mortality risk. This is the actual mortality within the group that was using radio in their hobby quite a lot. They were members of this association. Leukemias were elevated significantly in several different categories in terms of deaths in this group compared to what you would expect to see in the population. This is a study of Polish military personnel exposed to radar and radio microwave exposures, looking at incidence of various kinds of cancers. And we see an increased incidence statistically in all these cancers with a greater emphasis on the leukemias. This is a study of Air Force personnel. The study stratified by the intensity of their calculated exposure based on their job. Pilots have more exposure. They're up front where the radio is. And how many months they had that exposure level. They stratified it out that way and saw an increased odds ratio for brain tumor above a certain level of exposure. In Netanya, Israel, a cell phone tower was set up in 1996. And you see, the tower was right down here at the coast, so the exposure started here and went into the city. The power density in the exposed area where they researched this study was far below 0.53 microwatts per centimeter squared. It was 1,000 times less than the FCC permitted guidelines for power exposure. And what they did was compare cancer rates during the second year of exposure.
Exposure at the source?
This is exposure in the neighborhood.
In
the neighborhood, outside the buildings the people were living in. And they looked at the cancer rates in 677 long-term residents compared to 1,200-some matched controls living farther away in another area of the city. This is the first tower put into this city. And this is what they saw during that first 2 years. People, this is the city as a whole, far from the tower, close to the tower, significant increase in female cancers, this is male, female, and combined. Breast cancer appears to be particularly susceptible to this kind of problem. In Austria, there was a cell phone tower. This is the older analog cell phone tower operating from 1984 to 97. And they did a case control study of cancer patients living within 1,200 meters of this tower. And they measured the exposure levels on the exterior of their residences. And then they statistically crunched the numbers to see what their risk of cancer was. And what they saw, here, these are the two heaviest exposure levels. This is greater than 1,000 microwatts per meter squared. The FCC guidelines in microwatts per meter squared, 6 million is the permitted levels. And here, these people were exposed to more than 1,000. All cancers, breast cancers, brain cancer, this bar should go up to 121. This is 30. It didn't fit on here. Significant increased risk. Now, these are studies where you're looking at a town where they put in a tower, one tower in a town, and looked at the data. A study was done in 2011, published in Belo Horizonte, Brazil, which is the capital of Minas Gerais state, population of 2,258,000 in 2010. And it's rated by the UN as having the best quality of life in Latin America in 2007. And by 2006, 856 cell phone towers have been installed in the city. So what the researchers did was they mapped every cell phone tower in the city. They took the health department records to locate the residents of everyone who had died of cancer in the city between 1996 and 2006. And they calculated the distance between the deceased individual's residence and the closest cell phone tower in meters. And this is what they got. This blue line would be the null hypothesis. And what they saw was that distance is closer than 500 meters or closer, you have a significant increase in the risk of dying of cancer. Now I'm going to talk about fertility, and there's more on that significant in terms of animal studies in the material I've given you than I'm going to discuss here. I'm just going to talk about sperm counts and human fertility in terms of sperm. Sperm counts have been dropping since the last 20 years, like in New Zealand, 2.5% per year. There's some suggestion pesticides are implicated, and there's some suggestion that microwave RF may also play a role in this. Here in this study, they took some human sperm and exposed it for 5 minutes, 10 centimeters from a transmitting cell phone. The power density was 20 microwatts per centimeter squared, 30 times less than the FCC permitted limit of 600. And what you see is you've got fewer fast sperm, fewer slowly progressing sperm, more sperm that aren't moving at all after 5 minutes of exposure. This study didn't like being converted from Keynote to PowerPoint. This slide didn't. But what they looked at was 361 men being evaluated for infertility. And they divided them into four groups according to their active cell phone use. I mean, they picked men being evaluated because they were getting sperm samples from them in a clinic. And this group was not using a phone. This group's using it less than 2 hours a day. Here, 2 to 4 hours a day. Here, greater than 4 hours a day. And individuals using a phone 2 or more hours a day had significant decrease in sperm count, motility, viability, and normal morphology. In this study, they exposed sperm for 16 hours under isothermal conditions, so there was no question that heating had anything to do with it because they eliminated that variable. What they saw was decreased vitality and motility, increased reactive oxygen species, free radicals, in sperm cells and in mitochondria within those sperm cells. a study in Argentina published 2012 took sperm and incubated them at room temperature, lap distance from a laptop computer that was transmitting Wi-Fi, and 3 centimeters below the transmitting computer for 4 hours of exposure. And they kept the temperature constant. And compared to controls that were incubated under the same conditions without the RF exposure, they saw a decrease in progressive sperm, increase in immobility, increase in fragmented DNA. Now, if I'm going to talk about this subject, I have to talk about the risk of brain tumors with cell phones, because every 3 years you read an article in the media saying another study has shown there isn't a risk. And these articles were written by journalists who read the summary of the study but didn't look at the data. The Interphone study published in 2010 is one that was quoted as saying that there was no risk. They said there was no trend of increasing risk. This study was a large study done at multiple centers, and it was funded in significant part by the telecommunications industry. And they stratified their data out. They called somebody who was exposed, anyone that used a cell phone, once in one call a week for at least 6 months. They considered you in the risk group. So they had a lot of people in the risk group who didn't have a whole lot of hours of use. And that kind of diluted the risk group out some. At the very top end, with greater than 1,640 hours of lifetime exposure, they saw a significant increase in risk for glioma. But what they said in their summary was, we didn't see any trend of increasing risk. Because it doesn't trend up, it just goes flat till you get to a threshold, and then you've got a problem. And the journalists said, oh, they didn't see a trend. If we look at the data for the top exposed group, this is the odds ratio for meningioma in that group, stratified by hours of use. In the highest use group, if they accumulated those hours in less than in 4 years or less, this was their risk, as compared to 5 to 9 years, 10 years. And this slide shows the risk of it being, was the tumor on the same side that they held the cell phone on? And statistically, there was a significant, it was twice as likely, that tumor was twice as likely to be found on the same side of their head as where they held a cell phone in the highest use cohort. This shows risk of acoustic neuroma on the same side versus the opposite side with less than 5 years of cell phone use. This is all from the Interphone study. And here's the odds risk for a brain tumor of any kind, glioma or meningioma, with greater than 7 years of use. This is from their latest published data. And the Interphone study, at this point, when this was published in 2011, the authors could no longer say that they couldn't find any evidence of increased risk. So what they said in their summary was they couldn't find any evidence of increased risk with less than 10 years of exposure. And that was what was reported in the media. And with this study, they said, well, we did see this increased trend in people with greater levels of exposure, but the data really needs to be replicated. Even though this data was a replication of their previous study, and it's replicated by all the studies done by the group in Sweden that isn't funded by the cell phone industry. And that group is the Hardell Group. They're one of the first groups to start studying this. The cell phone rollout happened first in Scandinavia. Cell phones were invented there. They had networks before anybody else. And doctors there were the first people to start wondering if they were seeing more brain tumors from this. This group also controlled for use of portable phones in the home, the in-home cordless phones. Now, what we've got here is cordless phones, mobile phones, both. And this is the risk by years of use for glioma, one kind of type of brain tumor.
you're getting close to wrapping up.
Yes.
I think we'd like some discussion as well.
Yes. This is the risk for astrocytoma stratified in the same way. This is the risk for a brain tumor by whether the cell phone's on the same side as where the tumor was or not. Same side, opposite side, people who are ambidextrous. And this is cumulative hours of use of any brain cancer. By the time there's 2,000 of use, we've got over twice the risk. And this is the tumor risk of any brain cancer by age of first use. If people start using cell phones before they're 20, the risk is significantly higher because their skulls are thinner.
The line,
this is my last slide.
Is that right?
Pardon me?
The line's the odds ratio of 1.
Yes, the line is the odds ratio of 1. Mm-hmm. And this is the risk for astrocytoma by age of first use. This is cordless phone, this is cell phone, and this is both. So someone who starts using a cell phone at age less than 20 years has almost five times as much risk of developing an astrocytoma. And that's the data that's showing in the research today. This is a much larger, that's my last slide. There's a lot more discussion of this in the details in the handouts that I've provided you with. I am done. And I thank you very much for the opportunity to do this.
Let me ask the question. What would you propose we do this in a practical sense that we might actually be able to start working on?
Well,
let's say we take what you say
seriously. Yeah, okay.
Evidence. We take it seriously.
Yeah.
I've been working on this issue since 25 years ago, where I got Monoma County to put cell tower standards in. Not very good standards, but...
Well, what's happening in America right now is the cell towers have rolled out, and we're getting exposed to more and more outside our homes. We're also being exposed to quite a bit of this inside our homes with Wi-Fi routers, and that's a voluntary thing. What's happening now is the states are all doing initiatives to put Wi-Fi into all the schools because it's the cheapest way to give everybody internet access and teach kids how to function in the 21st century. So now we're immersing people inside and outside. If you look at what's happening in Europe, in 2008, the National Library in Europe removed the Wi-Fi from the library because too many of their staff were getting sick. And the main the libraries and the medical schools, or the Sorbonne, the various large universities in Paris, started removing Wi-Fi from their libraries the next year. So they're beginning to take Wi-Fi out of their public spaces while we're putting it in. I think you've got several questions to ask in terms of the public health of this state. I think we're going to keep seeing more and more people with electrical hypersensitivity. And that's going to create, as more people know someone who has that problem, it's going to change the political climate. If you take this seriously, then you have to ask yourselves, what can we do about this? And start looking into, what part of this turf do you have jurisdiction over versus the federal government? You have no control of cell phone tower sightings. You might be able to have some influence on whether we put Wi-Fi into all the schools, that kind of thing, in public places within the state. And I haven't studied that enough to have a lot of concrete advice on specifics for you. I saw my mission is to provide you with clear information. In France, 2 weeks ago, they passed a law banning Wi-Fi in the creches where kids less than 3 years of age are kept daycare. There's a lot of daycare in France because the government pays for it. They've banned Wi-Fi there. They've banned advertisements to children less than 16 from cell phone manufacturers. They've mandated that everybody that sells cell phones has to sell a hands-free option. And they're trying to figure out how to create areas in their cities that have less RF where people who are electrically hypersensitive can function within an urban environment. Because there's enough people now with EHS in France that they've got people wandering around in the Alps looking for a valley they can live in where they're not getting exposed. That they're the most extreme case. So one can look at what's going there and kind of see which way the wind will be blowing here later. I don't know how specific an answer this is to your question.
Dr. Paul, do you have an opinion on that?
Yeah, I think there are a lot of things that can be done that are practical. But, you know, when you add them up, of course, they amount to quite a number of changes. Let me just mention a few things. There's no reason why a laptop shouldn't have shielding material on its base, so that if people are actually using it on their lap, they're not zapping themselves to incredibly high levels. The same thing is true of tablets on the back. I mean, people often have their tablets like this, and if you have shielding in the back, that's easy to do. It's not being done. There's no reason why the emissions from, for instance, cordless phones could not be made much less. How can you do that? Very simple. Most cordless phones are designed to be used over 200 feet. Most people use them like within 20 feet of the base. If you cut down that signal by a factor of 100, you could use it within 20 feet of the base, and you'd be getting 1/100th of the radiation. Cell phone bases in this country all radiate 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. They don't have to. The only time they need to radiate is when you're making or receiving a phone call. So people who sleep near a cell phone base are getting radiated all the time. There are a lot of simple things that can be done, and the problem is they're not being done because of lack of public awareness and because of denial on the part of the industries. And I think that, you know, these things can be done practically, they can be done easily. That doesn't mean everything can be done easily. I think the problem of Wi-Fi in the schools is a big one, and it seems to me it's big for at least three different reasons. One is that the Wi-Fi fields that are set up in the schools, basically they're not worrying about exposures. And so some people who are close to the antennae may be getting 1,000, 10,000 times as much exposure as somebody who's further away, and they can both use it. So the way these things are designed, it seems to me, is extremely poor. But there's another problem in the schools, and that is, of course, the computers are all radiating back. And so you have a classroom full of students with computers. They're all radiating each other. That's a more difficult problem to deal with. And then there's a third problem, and this is basically one that that Barry Trower raised when he was visiting in Portland a few months ago. Barry Trower, as you may know, is a military intelligence expert from the UK. And so he has access to a lot of classified information. He can't talk about it, but he knows about it. And some parts of it he can talk about. And what he has said is that the wavelength that's being used for Wi-Fi is a particularly damaging wavelength biologically. Okay, so the Wi-Fi system basically is very poorly designed for that reason as well. So you can see these things, you know, there are a lot of complications, but there's also a lot of things you can do about them.
I have one thing to add on the Wi-Fi in the schools question. I was talking last week with the school system in my town, sharing this information with them, and they've already bought the hardware, and they've got all these iPads, and they see it as a tremendous teaching tool to have software on there. And one thing we were both talking about was, I mean, a Wi-Fi router is transmitting 24 hours a day whether you're using it or not. It's just going bat, 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 bat all the time. It'd be possible for them to load the iPads and then turn off the router and turn it off when it's not being used. If the schools had a policy of doing that, that could reduce exposure significantly. And I don't think they want the kids just be surfing the web all day long on their iPads. They want to put learning stuff on there and use it. So it'd be possible to think about using it in a way that minimizes the amount of time these things are actually transmitting. Another thing that will come down the line is an invention called Li-Fi that I didn't have time to talk about in my talk. It's possible to use light-emitting diodes and a receiver on a computer and a modem transmitting with light and have more bandwidth than Wi-Fi. In 5 years, this will probably be commercially available. They're really working this up in Europe right now. And it's possible that 5 or 10 years from now, if you want this kind of access in the school, you could do it all with light from LEDs rather than with radio.
Let me ask if there are other questions around me.
Yes.
Yes. So the question I have goes back to the standards that we talked about earlier, which I assume are federal standards for exposure. So when were those developed, or were they developed, and are they ever updated?
I think the last ones were promulgated in 1996, and they're talking about changing them or reevaluating them right now, but I don't think they finished doing so. The industry, one of the biggest problems here is a lot of people have a vested interest in not acknowledging there might be a problem, so then it's harder to seek solutions. But these standards are way behind the science. And I think that one tends to see this in a lot of areas in the environmental science.
Sure. Thank you.
Dr. Harker.
Okay. Way behind the science. So you threw a whole lot of data at us. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And we can't possibly process all that now. Are there some review articles that that really show the preponderance of scientific evidence to be on the side that you claim is right?
One of the pieces of testimony I submitted is an 87-page review that I wrote.
Dan Olis, is it?
Thanks. Okay.
For the Eugene Water and Electric Board to help them look at this issue with a group of doctors in Eugene. And that that document reviews a lot of the research and reviews a lot of the review articles and references them. So that's a pretty coherent doorway into taking a look at this science. And that's the purpose of that article.
Yeah, I cited three of the reviews in my paper that was just, I think you have access to.
I haven't accessed everything I have access
to. Okay, yeah, nobody's got time for it. There were three reviews on cancer, and they, in fact, talked about many of the things that Dr. Dart just talked about. There are reviews on that. And I reviewed in my the paper that I published last year. I reviewed the paper, the evidence on single stranded breaks in DNA, the kind of assays that he showed you in that paper. So there are quite a number of places where you can find this. Let me just, if I can make a comment about, you know, if you ask industry about that. What I think you're going to get, and what I've seen published from them, is that the literature is inconsistent. Okay. Now, I went through the literature on this single-stranded break things, and it's true. In some studies, they reported effects, and in other studies, they didn't. But they're using different conditions. They're looking at different types of cells. These things you expect to behave differently because they are biologically different. They have different numbers of voltage-gated calcium channels, etc. There are a lot of changes from one cell type to another. You don't expect them to behave all the same way. And in fact, there were two studies in which they compared different cell types, and they found some, using the same techniques then, they found some cells responded and others didn't. So I think that what the industry says is based on a false assumption, and that is that all these things should behave the same way, but biology is much more complex than that.
Okay, thanks. So I'd love to hear from the industry at some point, but also, I mean, that bifurcating pathway that you showed that started with the calcium channels and showed elevation of nitric oxide and cyclic G in the physiological process side, which was perturbed on the other side, that was, if I remember correctly, a variety of cell types amalgamated into that.
Well, a variety of different conditions, yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm. I thought the answer is to put calcium channel blockers in the water supply. Would you propose that?
No, there are a lot of side effects of calcium channel blockers.
Oh, yeah, I noticed that. Right.
So, yeah, that's problematic. Even in treatment, I think it's problematic, but yeah.
Well, this is very interesting. We hear these things are not yet in OLIS, but they will be in OLIS
before
we're done.
Yes.
Yeah. His 98-page is not. That was a hyperlink.
The report, the second one there.
I sent you one document. I gave you two links to the other one, the one I gave you last night.
It's a 76-page. The one that we have here is a 76-page on OLIS.
It's either in OLIS or it will be in OLIS.
No, it is. It's DART P report. The written info is not.
Okay.
The report is.
So don't look for anything that's not in OLIS now. Is that
well, it's in. You might add something else, but your 76-page paper is in there. And I would just say I want to recognize David Morrison in the audience. He's a constituent of mine who's very concerned, particularly about Wi-Fi in the schools, and has had a lot of conversations with the school board. And I met with Barry Chower, his name is, when he came through from England, and he's really, you know, having had a military career and seen a lot of this in terms of military applications, has now become very alarmed and is spending the latter part of his life trying to alert people to the concerns. And so I've been reading things that have come through and sufficiently concerned myself that I've taken some common step things, like, you know, put my cell phone on airplane mode. I live with my cell phone. I keep it a little farther from my head. I do airplane mode. I tell my kids, you know, I want healthy grandchildren when they're teenagers. So I've not said you can't be on Wi-Fi, but I'm trying to take a precautionary principle and learn more and be very open to what is the emerging science in this field. So just trying to get up to speed, and I really appreciate the testimony of several people here.
Could I make a quick comment? I just met Dr. Dart a few minutes ago, just before the start of the meeting. We had never communicated before. We did not coordinate our presentations. I just want to make that clear. So this wasn't something that we coordinated at all. We never communicated about any of these things.
Well, and it's interesting because you're a research scientist and you're a practicing doctor. And yet there's a lot of common judgment.
Why wouldn't you have coordinated here?
Well, I've read his article.
See, that'd be a good thing to happen, not a bad thing.
So this is also, I think David Morrison provided this good reading material when we get out of the session. And
Jerry Trower's paper is in there, by the way.
In here.
Okay,
well, I do appreciate this. This is something that's been on my mind for, as they say, more than 20 years. Having lived very close to a cell tower, there are areas in the city of Portland, in my district, that are, I think, very problematic in terms of...
Can I just add one more thing? When I went through the OHSU tour of the new building, and I asked the head of research there, are you doing any studies in this at all? They said no. And my hope, if we are to pass any of that capital funds for the match for the Phil Knight Cancer Center Institute, we've all talked about hoping that there's research not only into gene therapy and treatment, but also into the upstream prevention. And I mentioned to Joe Robertson when he was through, I certainly hope this is one of the areas they do more research.
If I worked in an office building with with towers on the roof, I would not want to work on the top floor. I mean, I think this distance variable is an important variable. You still get effects, but I think people in the top floor of an office building with towers on the roof are at hazard. And so, have you seen any link with osteosarcoma? I'm chasing down another.
I'm not aware of that.
I would just add, when you're in a room with
he's got to come up.
He has to
come up.
Come on up and introduce yourself.
I'm Eagle Leap, so.
Yeah, we're almost done, so sorry, this will be the last.
My name's Sean Averill, attorney from Washington, and I just wanted to mention that you mentioned that you wouldn't want to live next to a cell tower or in a building with the cellular equipment on the top floor. When you have a Wi-Fi router within a room, because of the distance and because it's the same type of radiation, it's effectively living in a room, you know, underneath the cell towers that might be on a roof. So I just wanted to mention that.
Yeah, my point was I'd rather be on the first floor than on the 12th floor if I worked in that building.
Well, I'm always amused because every time I drive through Salem, just north of the Market Street exit, there's this big building there with like six cell towers on top, and it's always for lease.
Everybody's for died lease. That used to work there. That's fine. Thank you very much for your presentation. It's very helpful. This is something we'll keep on our agenda.
Thank you.
We are adjourned.
Okay.